You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today. Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour, episode number 7, your weekly podcast covering retro gaming and technology news. With me, Dan Wood.
And I'm Ravi Abbott.
Episode number 7.
Oh my God.
Where has the time gone?
I know. Well, it's... We're going to get to 10.
If it kills us.
Yeah.
Now, this week, I want to give a shout out to the guys over at Retro Asylum Podcast.
Yeah, the Drisk gave us a nice little message the other day, and we're going to hopefully meet up with those guys at Blackpool.
And
yeah,
these are,
play
these
Blackpool.
Are another podcast from the UK, aren't they?
Oh,
been
yeah.
A long time.
They've been going for ages. They've got a massive back catalogue of podcasts, and they kind of look at, you know, two or three games every episode, then discuss the games. It's kind of like, you know, a book club or a game club kind of style.
We'll drop a link in the show notes. If you like our show, I'm sure you'll like theirs as well.
Yep.
And what a guest we've got this week then. One of the big boys.
One of the big boys. We had Sensible on. Now we've got their rivals, Bitmap Brothers.
Yeah, Mike Montgomery from the Bitmap Brothers. Now, obviously, if you listen to the show regularly, Ravi and I, massive Amiga fans, still today and back in the day. And we're talking games like Bitmap Brother games. What? Chaos Engine?
Yeah, Speedball 2.
Gods.
Yeah, Xenon as well. And, you know, he's the managing director, so he's the top of Bitmap.
We're going to get the scoop then, the inside story on the Bitmap Brothers in around 40 minutes from now. Getting into this week's news though, there's a new retro gaming documentary that's just been released. Well, more retro technology really, more about computers.
Oh, is it actually out?
Well, this is called Growing the 8-Bit Generation.
Ah, okay.
Now, this was a Kickstarter back in 2014. And what's quite interesting is it was actually Jack Tramiel's last ever interview.
Oh, wow.
They recorded it months before he died.
Oh, wow. So this will all be stuff that we've not seen before then.
Yeah, I think I did watch, do you remember when the Commodore 64 celebrated its 30th birthday? And there was that interview with Jack on YouTube where everyone was there and Steve Wozniak was there with him and that. I think it was some Computer History Society.
Oh, yeah, I've noticed, just looking on the website now, they've got a picture of Woz. They've got, you know, all the top 8-bit people here. It's completely
amazing. Well, they spoke to 64 people when they're making this documentary. So Jack's in there, Jeff Minter, Bill Hurd from Commodore. He narrates the entire documentary, apparently, Bill Hurd.
I've got to go home and watch this. Stop doing the podcast.
Larry Tesler from Xerox PARC.
Oh, wow. The very early development.
So, I mean, if you're interested in the early days of personal computing, and even, you know, they kind of cover the IBM story and all that in here as well, by the looks of it. Now, this Kickstarter started a couple of years ago, but the people that backed it actually got the digital copies of the documentary at the time of recording this. It was last night, so on the 15th of February. Mm. But there is going to be a physical DVD and that released of it as well, and I think they're opening it to everyone like in the next few days, so hopefully by the time you hear this, it should be out.
It's kind of interesting, these things, because I looked at you know, Netflix, which is one of the most popular platforms, and they've got Bedrooms to Billions on.
Yeah.
And it's quite popular, and it, you know, I think that probably is spreading the computer story to a lot of people who haven't seen it before.
The only documentary I ever saw on mainstream TV, do you remember Triumph of the Nerds?
Triumph of the Nerds, no.
Cringely, I think it was. It was on probably about mid-90s, about 95. Actually, I think it was around the time Microsoft had just released Windows 95.
Ah, okay.
It was made in America, but Channel 4 showed it over here, and it was like a three-parter, and it was meant to detail the entire history of personal computing, but literally it was all IBM, Microsoft, and Apple.
I do remember an amazing one, which was with, was it Ian Lee?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was called Fum Candy. And it was basically about the start of the gaming. But he kind of met everyone, you know. He met the guy who did Space Invaders. And
oh, wow.
He went round. Matthew Smith was in it, you know, all the bedroom coders and stuff. It was really good. I think you can find that still on YouTube, actually. If I find it, I'll put it in the notes.
Yeah, I've not seen that, but Ian Lee is a hardcore... He writes in Retro Gamer magazine, doesn't he? You
know, yeah,
he's always loved his old school games. But it is cool to see these documentaries being made. And even, like, there was that one where Microsoft made it last year, trying to find, you know, the lost Atari treasures that were buried in the desert.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It is nice to see these kind of documentaries coming out. We mentioned Bedrooms to Billion, so hopefully we're going to have the creators of that on the show in the next few weeks.
Pirates of Silicon Valley as well.
That was a great movie, yeah.
Dramatised version. It's very good.
But also, there's one about the Amiga, Viva Amiga, but that's been in the making for about 6 years now.
And yeah, I've heard that it's going to be out. We saw quite a bit of it in Amsterdam.
Yeah, about a year ago.
We were there at a preview, but... I want to see it online.
Absolutely.
You know.
Well, it's great to see this one's been released now. So if you've got an interest in the early days, the 8-bit generation, it's called, and we'll pop a link in the show notes. Now, following up from a story we had last week about the new Sega Dreamcast.
Yes, the Project Dream. We are continuing talking about Project Dream because new news keeps coming out every time. So it looks like Project Dream are going to be funding themselves.
Interesting. So we thought it was going to be a crowdfunded project, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah. So they must have some financial backing or some kind of investors involved, because it says Project Dream has revealed that they'll be funding the development of the Sega console. They've also disclosed that they will not resort to crowdfunding the project and not ask fans for monetary support.
And also, we were kind of speculating as to what kind of architecture it was going to run on. What was I saying last week? It's going to be an Android thing, I thought it was going to be. But since then, they've actually
Raspberry
released...
Raspberry Pi.
And apparently it's going to be a PC/console hybrid, so pretty much like the PS4 and the Xbox One. It will make use of x86 architecture while sporting a customised NVIDIA GTX 740 GPU, an Intel Core i5 at 3.4 GHz and 8 GB of DDR3 RAM. So basically it sounds like a PS4.
So do you think they could get an old original Dreamcast emulator in
there? Oh, absolutely,
and then have new titles like Shenmue and... all these kind of x86 titles that are coming out.
Well, even you remember the Dreamcast, that ran on Windows CE, didn't it? That was its foundation.
Yeah, so, I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess if they could somehow make Windows games run on this thing, then...
Yeah, yeah, that could be good. And long before the Xbox did their, or PlayStation did their kind of operating system.
Well, I remember I think the original Xbox came out of the Dreamcast, didn't it? Because Sega had fallen down and they'd asked Microsoft, you know, to help them with the OS for the Dreamcast. That's how Windows CE came on board. And then when the Dreamcast got discontinued, or, you know, when it was on death's door, Microsoft were like, oh, well, we've kind of put this effort into developing this console technology. We'll just make our own.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, the Xbox did come out of the Dreamcast project, really. If Sega had continued, maybe the Xbox would never have been on the market. So
You never know.
Maybe the Dreamcast will come back, though, and whip its ass.
Yeah, you would have had something prettier than that big, ugly black box.
My Xbox One.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does look a bit like a late 80s video cassette recorder.
Yeah, and it sounds like a plane taking off as well when you've got too much dust in there.
Now, I thought this was quite interesting. Do you ever visit archive.org?
Yeah, I do actually, because they have the Wayback Machine, which is great for visiting old websites. And they also have loads of podcasts on there and stuff.
Yeah, watching it hours on there, actually.
I'm not sure.
I also see a lot of people complaining that, you know, archive.org is too slow. And like, yeah, they are archiving the entire internet. You know what I mean? It's quite a big job, to be fair.
Yeah.
But also, there is a game section on there too. Now, if you get a console or a computer, always the first place I look, you know, the TOSEX? So they're massive collections. They aim to be every single software title that was released on any platform. And they've got, I downloaded the Amiga CD32 one, the CDTV. They've got I got a Commodore 64 one off there recently, so you download it, it's a massive, like, 64 gigabyte zip file, and pretty much every different version, even on the Amiga ones, they've got about 12 different versions of Cannon Fodder on there with all the different crack throws and stuff on.
I've seen, like, the Genesis ones that they have for Everdrives and stuff.
It's an awesome website, and they also put a load of arcades up last year as well, so the entire MAME TOSEC is on there.
Oh, wow.
Quite how they get around copyright, I don't know. But now they've just released Windows 3.x games... that you can actually play in a browser.
Oh my God, I've got to look for Sim Hotel or Sim Tower even.
Well, this is, basically the early 90s kind of stuff. You know, stuff like Lander 3 I'm looking at here. I remember that. Lander, that was a great game. Missile, Flight Commander 2. So literally you go through, click these games and you can play them in a little Java applet on your browser, which obviously, if you want to play old Windows games, it's often easier to download DOSBox or run it in VMware. But if you just want a quick blast of an old Windows game while you're at work.
And these will be here forever as well. You know, like sites, emulator sites or sites with DOSBox, mm-hmm. they tend to come and go, but archive.org will stay.
Well, even they've got a really good magazine section as well.
Oh, they've got scans of the...
Got every issue of pretty much every Amiga magazine on there as PDFs.
I really need to look more at archive.org. I feel I've not used it enough. This is great.
It is. Well, they only put them up about 2 years ago, but I've got a lot of old Amiga formats and CU Amigas and stuff, and part of me thinks, should I just get rid of them? Because I often find it easier just to open it on my iPad on archive.org and you can find the issue, and you look at it full screen, you just swipe through the pages. It's a lot easier, but yeah, it's a great resource.
I'm just noticing at the top, I haven't been on archive.org for years, and they've got, you know, a video section, audio section, software. This is amazing.
Yeah, they've got so much stuff on there. It's one of those websites, you can just delve into it and you can be there like all day looking through all. Like, I didn't know they had that on there, I didn't know you had that.
Just and get lost in there.
Well, even the video section, I think it's like bigger than YouTube, the amount of video they've got on there. It's huge. And there is actually an app that you can download. I know you've got a Kodi setup recently, didn't you? There's a Kodi plugin for it.
Oh, excellent.
So yeah, I can just browse that all day, go in the computer section, all the episodes of like the Computer Chronicles are on
so
there.
So I can look at the video on Kodi. Oh.
You're watching with the plugin. So.
Amazing.
Archive.org, I'm sure you know about it already, but yeah, delve into it and have a little look at what they've added over the last couple of years, if it's been a while. Now, following on from, I mentioned Amiga format a moment ago.
Yeah, the classic AF, yes.
There is a new AF these days. Oh. I thought, because we got an email in the week, didn't we, about this...
Yeah, Amigaville, which is a new magazine. Now, I'm not sure what's going on with it because the guy's got up to about 4 or 5 episodes, I think.
Okay.
He's doing it all on his own. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a tough job, but it looks really good.
This is a digital only, isn't it? So I bought his recent issue. I think it's issue 4. But we have read since then. He's apparently discontinuing it now. So I think you can still get them online if you want to look at it. But we thought this might be quite interesting, you know, just talking about the Amiga in particular here, to have a look at kind of that there are still some paper Amiga magazines around.
It's crazy because it's like, it feels like it's still alive if you're still able to get a magazine talking about it through your door or, you know, even if you're printing one off yourself. But crazily, we have one which is actually in W.H. Smith.
Yeah, there is one in the high street. Not an entire magazine, but...
No, it's a page every 2 weeks.
Yeah, used to be every week, didn't it?
Yeah, it's in a magazine called Micromart, which mm-hmm. basically we have Amiga Mart, Pac Mart, and Mac Mart.
There's Atari in the back as well, isn't
there? Yeah. So they've got all these different ones. And a few years ago, they actually removed the Amiga section and then suddenly got... abuse and
everyone went apeshit, didn't they?
Yeah. And now our friend Sven Harvey actually writes it, and we've mm-hmm. met him at quite a few Amiga events. Really, really nice guy.
Mentioned a few of our videos in the past. We'll have to send him a link to the podcast. But yeah, so if you're ever in W.H. Smith, Micromart, it's really more of a trade magazine, isn't it, for the computer industry?
Yeah, it's also really cheap as well.
About 99p or £2, is it?
About £2. It's not like your, you know, retro gamer. Mm-hmm. It's a good little thing to pick up.
And another one is Amiga Future. Now, do you subscribe to this?
I used to subscribe to Amiga Future, but I found actually... because doing this podcast and shows like this, I'm looking up news all the time. So the stuff that I'm reading in print is a bit late, but then there's really nicely written articles in there. So,
well, Amiga Future, I did sub for a while, but my subscription lapsed to it. And I occasionally get the odd, you know, if I'm buying something from Amiga Kit, it's an online Amiga retailer, I'll generally always bundle in a copy of Amiga Future in my basket to get shipped out as well. And that's been going a long time. Aren't they up to like issue 100 now or something?
They must
there. Yeah, they've been going a good long while. But again, it's a full colour, glossy Amiga magazine. Does it come out every 2 months, is it, or 3 months?
I think it is. And they also have like special guest writing articles in there. So Trevor Dickinson, who ran Aeon, the main Amiga company at the moment, he's basically writing reflections and kind of historical stuff about his collection of Amigas and about older machines and, you know, stories about companies that we don't really mm-hmm. remember what happened to them.
Yeah.
And it's quite funny, actually, because quite a few of them turn into porn companies.
Really?
I've been reading a few articles. And it's...
Might have to start buying this again.
No, there's one called Softwood.
That was set up for that, wasn't it? Come on. But yeah, Amiga Future, like you said, when it comes through the door... and you've got this glossy magazine. It kind of feels like the days when CU Amiga used to fall on my doormat and
Amiga totally format.
And even do a version with the CD-ROM, don't they?
Yeah. Well, I remember I used to walk into W.H. Smith's and I used to just stand there proud because all the other geeks would be like searching through hundreds of stacks for Atari magazines or something, and we'd just have a line of pristine, massive-selling Amiga magazines, and it was like...
It was always too many, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, far too many.
If I ever got money, I'd always buy Amiga format every month.
Oh, I was a CU Amiga guy.
CU. I started buying CU a lot more, probably after about 95. When the cover CDs came in, I started buying it religiously. Yeah. I got it
occasionally before that. CU CD.
They were the best CDs, though, weren't they? Amiga Shopper I used to buy every month until it went, because it was cheap at first.
God, I forgot about that. My dad used to buy that, yeah.
But it was 99p when that came out, and like, you know, I was only about like 11 or something. Yeah. But later on, it got quite expensive with two floppy disks and that, and I thought I might as well just get Amiga format. But there's also Amiga User International, I used to buy that. And that had a bit more of a, it was more of a general technology magazine.
But these kind of magazines, they kind of show the culture at the time, like... Games Master was a magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
And that became a TV show and a massive hit and kind of CVG as well. I remember that was massive. And at the time, they were, you know, really, really strong, powerful forces. They could review a game and destroy it.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, even like, you know, talking about Amiga User International, I remember reading about mini discs for the first time in that. They were doing like, you know, kind of a feature on mini discs.
This is the future.
Cool. Yeah. Then I got my first mini display like, you know, 8 years after that or something. But... it's just cool, I mean, to have, like, paper magazines again. So if you are interested in a modern-day Amiga magazines, we'll pop links to these in the show notes as well. And obviously, there is Retro Gamer that covers all platforms. I'm sure everybody that listens to our podcast is aware of, but they gave us a shout on their website last week, so...
Yeah, but also, they've got these books that are coming out that Retro Gamer are doing. So they're doing, like, the Amiga book or the Atari book, the SNES, the NES book, and it's basically like a one-off special, completely full of information. So,
and yeah, they're about like normally 12-13 quid, aren't they? But they are proper like encyclopedias, aren't they?
The Amiga book, people were buying it and selling on eBay because it was 50
quid. Yeah. I remember. Okay, this is quite an interesting title you write here, Ravi. Minecraft Boris Johnson.
Yeah, so this is a London Games Festival,
okay,
which is a 3-year program and it's £1.2 million investment from the Mayor of London's office, which is interesting because he's basically saying they want to promote games more in London as it's, you know, a massive financial centre. So the way that they opened this was they had a Boris Johnson skin in Minecraft and had him actually talking.
I want to get him on his bike.
Yeah, that's it.
So essentially this is going to be like the UK version of E3 then?
Yeah, it looks like it. It's got a fringe festival as well, and you know, it's kind of really small, and they're just trying to start and boost the economy, so it won't be a massive event, but...
It's running for 10 days, it says, 1st to the 10th of April 2016, with 15 official events across 10 locations. So yeah, you know, it's two a day pretty much, not even that really, is it?
But... And they're saying it will raise £35 million in new revenue for businesses, hopefully, and add £10 million to the London economy, around 300 jobs. So they are investing in gaming, which is... really good, actually.
That's amazing, though, because I think the nearest one to us, you get Gamescom over in Germany, don't you?
Yeah.
So I often see videos from there, but yeah, there's never really been anything like that in the UK, like proper...
I remember years ago, they used to have stuff in this NEC arena, which was a big kind of... But we'd have the Ideal Home exhibition. So we wouldn't have, like, you know, and you'd go and see the computers there. You wouldn't go to a dedicated...
At least when you go to E3, there's the Playboy exhibition next door usually, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. That's where we're going next.
Yeah, I always used to hear it whenever I watch things from E3 or CES, maybe it's CES actually. And they're always like, yeah, I think there's like the Las Vegas porn conventions going on in the room next to it. So you get all these geeks wandering in there after the show.
Yeah, we've lost half of the show.
Yeah, we're trying to find Microsoft stand. Who are you? And this one's quite interesting then. It kind of follows on from the guests that we've got coming up in just a bit.
Yeah, it's just our timing's so good as well, you know.
Like we planned the show.
Yeah, like the Lemmings' 25th birthday's just happened, and who did we have on last week, you know, and the week before.
Yeah, we only realised that after, but yeah. But the Bitmap Brothers collection for the Amiga CD32 is out.
Yes, and this is the complete works of the Bitmap Brothers. So basically, they've put everything on here. The Chaos Engine 2, God's Magic Pocket, Speedball, Xenon 2, you know, And this is lots of entertainment, but also what they've done is they've remapped the keypads as well. So
to work on the CD32.
Yeah, so it's a lot easier to play. And it's playable for the first time without a keyboard.
Woohoo!
Yes, yeah, so you can just do it with the pads.
And looking at it here now, we will say this is an unofficial release.
Unofficial.
Maybe
yeah.
We don't mention it to Mike Montgomery when he's on in half an hour. But yeah, you get all of the Bitmap Brothers games for the Amiga, and they put it on this really nice launcher as well. So you just select it from this menu when you put the disc in. And they've also got, what's his name? That alien Colin? Is it from Xenon?
I think it is, yeah.
I remember the CD, I think it's the CD TV version of Xenon 2, and he's in there, he goes, "Hello, my name is Colin," at the beginning. That was always hilarious. It's cracked me up. But yeah, if you haven't played that, you'll be like, what?
Yeah, no, I've never seen that. It sounds
but yeah,
good.
So pretty much every Bitmap Brothers game on a single CD-ROM that you can download for free.
Oh, yeah.
And play on your CD32 or emulator.
That's it. And also the Bitmap Brothers games, I think the best version was the Chaos Engine version on the CD32.
I'm looking here though, it says they're all Amiga 500 versions.
Ah,
so maybe it won't be the AGA one.
Maybe because they're so small, they've had to put them on the one CD.
Maybe you can play these on an Amiga 500 with a CD-ROM drive or something as well, if they're not AGA versions, or a CD-TV with a bit of extra RAM. Now, we've been talking about this ZX Spectrum reboot a bit over the last few weeks, and there is another development now on the Vega project.
Yes, and one of our listeners, Joshua Andrew Coburn, has sent us this link. So it's our first user-submitted piece of news. Oh, I'm very excited.
Now, this is an Indiegogo then, so it hasn't been released yet by the looks of it.
Yeah, this is a crowdfunding project, but I've seen a hell of a lot on it online because everyone is pushing it at the moment, and the picture of it looks bloody great.
So explain what it is then.
It is your Vega, which was the Spectrum before, a remake, but it's handheld this time. So it's an LCD console, 1,000 license games, but you can also connect it up to your television as well.
So, yeah, it is a handheld console then. So you've got a D-pad, a couple of buttons. You've got some keys there. What are they? What's on that? SE 2 and 1.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm not a Spectrum guy, so I don't know which one of the popular ones. But it's got micro SD as well, and you know, it's kind of a really actually portable. You know, there's probably been builds that have been tried to dumb, but you've had to stick them in the wall, or you've had to, you know.
And the Vega, that was the one that was made in Nottingham, wasn't it? That came out last summer, the small one that only had 3 or 4 keys on there.
Yeah, the Vega. Now, I think now will be also a really good time just to mention this kind of user-submitted review of the Spectrum stuff, because we haven't been that clear on it, because there's a hell of a lot of them coming out. And Dreamcatcher's mentioned something on one of our forums.
And this is on the English Amiga board. Now, we posted our podcast in there, and Dreamcatcher, he actually, he's tried out one of these then, so it's not the Vega that he's talking about here then, is it? It's the one that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the one that's essentially a Bluetooth keyboard that interacts with your Android or iOS device.
Yeah. So he says the full-size one-on-one copy is just a Bluetooth keyboard interface with the Spectrum emulator app. Looking beyond, it looks a hell of a lot like a dead flashy spec with nothing inside. Yeah, it's more of a recreated Spectrum than your average cordless keyboard. It's a tad disappointing. Now, he says, the joypad-like Vega, on the other hand, looks cack.
Is this the one we're talking about here, then? The all-in-one, okay.
Yeah, but does not technically have a specky brain. It's kind of a device that can be used along with your telly. Now, hopefully this handheld device will look a bit better than the Vega. I think that's his main point.
Well, he says here this one's it's the only one that's endorsed by Sir Clive Sinclair himself.
So, okay.
Which they're quite keen to point out on their homepage to distance themselves from the dodgy Elite model.
Yes.
So, I mean, there is a lot of these around at the moment, and it kind of seems like after the original Vega got announced, everyone's kind of jumped on the bandwagon a little bit. But
no, so it's, thank you, Dreamcatcher, for clearing that up as well, because having input from specky guys is always helpful.
I mean, it does come with 1,000 games included, so I imagine most of the big ones are in here. Mm. And there are some fully functioning prototypes available. So it does look like it's a handheld that you can plug into your TV, essentially. I mean, it uses a D-pad and it's got these buttons, which is obviously not the way that you originally played Sinclair specky games. But if you want to play them on the go, I guess, you know, it might be a little bit more of an elegant solution than getting an emulator on your phone, at least. Next one, Coco Chameleon Public Preview.
Yes, so this is the Coco Chameleon, which we covered the other day. which was the retro VGS that got rebranded by Chameleon, mm-hmm. and it was a failed Indiegogo campaign. Now, they're saying that the Chameleon's actually been released, and they'll be selling newly made cartridges for the old classics that were never released in the USA. They'll also be producing brand new games by indie developers, and they're talking about they're already producing downloaded DLC for this Coco.
And this is an interesting project. This is the one, I mean, there is a lot of these kind of rebooted consoles around at the moment. If I said it's in the Atari Jaguar case, I'm sure most people will be like, oh, I know the one now. So the story behind this is they got hold of the molds that were originally used for the Atari Jaguar. And apparently doing that saved them an absolute fortune because it was a lot cheaper than making their own molds. Yeah. So that, to be fair, if you're going to make your console look like any console in history, which will be the last one that you pick?
Yeah.
Because I mean, I've read this on forums. Some guy's like, I got an Atari Jaguar when I was like 10 years old and it was the biggest heartbreak ever. So when I see that now, it just makes me depressed.
Well, so, it was called like, the toilet seat, wasn't it? That was
the CD-ROM
attachment.
Well, apparently this guy, the guys behind this have actually bought the CD molds as well. So.
Okay. I would think if they had a Jaguar thing, why aren't they doing Atari? Why is it, you know, Chameleon?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is essentially just an emulator that's got the Coleco branding on there, isn't it? Even Coleco themselves, they weren't originally a video games company. Didn't it stand for like something, leather company or something it was? Something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm honestly not all that convinced about this project. I know the manufacturers behind this have really pushed it insofar as, you know, this is a machine that's going to recreate those old memories because it's the last console that uses cartridges.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. My DLC thing, they're not producing DLC. They're actually going to produce carts only.
Yeah.
And it's going to be like, you get this cart and that's it.
But they're talking about that like it's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, like what, the games will be complete. You're not going to have updates.
I was reading an interview with the guys today. This is how I've kind of come across all this. It was from last summer, so whether they've kind of changed their stance a little bit since then, I'm not sure. But the guys behind it were saying their goal is to make sure, to basically get rid of this culture that we've got now of releasing a video game that you know is full of bugs, and we can fix it in 2 weeks, and we can get a patch that people will download. Their idea is they're going to get games out that are completely bug-free.
It's
but how can you ever guarantee that?
How can you do that with such a small audience? If Steam were doing it, then fair dues, because Steam are the main people that do that. You know, the amount of pre-releases I've joined, thought this is an amazing game. It's got half the features. I've got bored of it in half an hour, and then I don't want it when it comes out as a final.
Well, you know, it proves this. I mean, you look at old cartridge games are full of bugs. Even ones that came out of Sega and stuff, and they probably had, like, beta testing teams working around the clock for months.
Yeah.
This must be a team of, like, what, five guys?
Yeah.
How on earth are they going to ensure that it's bug-free? But also, another argument that I've seen on the forums, because, to be fair, I know, like, Gizmodo are really keen on this project. In kind of the retro community, though, everything I've seen about it's been pretty negative, if I'm honest. And a guy did make a really good point that a lot of the games that come out on this are not going to be dedicated Chameleon games, because who's going to develop for such a small audience?
Yeah, they won't be locked into the hardware.
No, it'll be stuff that'll also come out on Android, on Steam. But he made a good point insofar as this is going to lock out all DLC, because it's a cartridge, unless you buy a new physical product. So if they do release a bug fix, the guys on Android and Steam are going to get it. You're not if you've got this console. And what about if they release, like, you know, an extra bonus pack or something? You're not going to get it. So really all you're doing is buying this machine that you're not going to get any extra content for that everyone else on other platforms will.
But also these titles have to be absolutely classic because they have to be really high quality. Like, if you look at stuff that survived with bugs, well, you know, it's Mario 64, you know, and the backwards jumping bug, that's amazing, you know. So it might have some advantages.
But I think, you know, there's a reason that we don't use cartridges anymore. It's because they're too expensive to produce.
Yep.
They don't really fit in with the current landscape of gaming.
And faster loading times, that's what they always say, isn't it?
I mean, if these are going to be kind of retro titles anyway, I mean, how long does it take to load a, you know, like an NES game into an emulator? It's like 5 seconds, isn't it?
So, yeah, a clone of Pong.
You know, I'll always say well done to someone who's got an interesting project, but I think, you know, the only people that are going to buy this is, because it's not retro hardware. If you want to play old school systems, you can still buy them.
Yeah.
You could buy a Super Nintendo. For cheaper. Isn't this going to be like $300 or something as well as saying? It's expensive.
expensive and a weird mishmash hybrid of about three consoles.
And also reading into this article, I mean, you mentioned it was a failed Indiegogo.
Yeah, before. Retro VCS or VGS.
But apparently later on this month they're going to be putting it on Kickstarter, so...
Okay, so give it another shot, rebrand it.
Friday, February the 26th, 2016, it's going to go on there. The team also announced the first Kickstarter reward will be a $135 system that will come with one USB controller, HDMI cable, and a few of the add-ons as well. So, I mean, I was hearing that originally the price is going to be about $300 for this, so we'll see. You know, we'll follow its progress.
Yep.
Now, going even more old school than the Atari.
Yeah, well, this is a revival of another type of gaming, and this is board gaming.
You like board games?
Yeah, Monopoly. I don't tend to play Monopoly that much because I get really angry, like possessive.
We actually had an argument the other week. My girlfriend's parents were around. Yeah, we were playing Monopoly and like they were cheating. And I just went, oh, this is bollocks. I'm not playing that if you're not going to do the rules properly. Yeah. Haven't let me live it down since. But
oh, wicked. You had a scranny. That's great.
So tell us about these then. What's this? What's this new board games against humanity?
Well, this is Cards Against Humanity, which are basically these kind of little card games that you've got. There's one called Pandemic, one called Ticket to Ride, but also Monopoly, Cluedo, all of these things are selling again. Like 400% upsurge, they're saying, on the previous year. We've actually just had in Nottingham a dedicated board game shop open on Mansfield Road,
which is
a whole area. And you can go past at night and all the lights are on and you can just see nerds playing board games.
Do an episode from there.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest, we've actually started buying quite a lot of board games in the last like year.
Yeah.
We've got about like 12 maybe now. Even stuff like, the logo quiz. Because there was a bar we went in over Christmas, actually, and they had a load of board games out on the table, and everyone was just playing them over a cocktail and stuff, and it was really cool. We played this logo quiz. We bought it and played it over Christmas. But even, I went on eBay, and there was a game that I used to love when I was a kid called Key to the Kingdom.
Okay.
It was kind of a bit like, I wanted Hero Quest. Do you remember Hero Quest, the board game? I wanted that, but they didn't have any in stock, so my mum got me this. It was kind of like a cheaper version of it. But it was a game I loved, and I actually bought it off eBay for 16 quid, and it was like new old stock.
Yeah.
So I was showing my brother and my mum were all like, oh, we're going to have a go at that. So I think board games are becoming quite cool
again.
Well,
I was a nerd, so I was into Warhammer.
Yeah.
And Talisman was one of the early ones I used to play, and then Warhammer 40K, and that was all very board gamey, but for older kids, you know. But yeah, it's really interesting, and there's also a lot of kind of weird gaming nights that are going on. In Nottingham, we've got this thing called Drink and Draw. I don't know if you've heard of this, Dan. It's at Rough Trade Records. Basically, 200, 300 students turn up, get completely drunk, and then they tell them all to draw stuff, and they have to like submit it. And it's like a big drawing competition, and it sells out every week. They have to reject people because it gets so popular. Maybe it's because people are kind of, you know, I've noticed a lot of bars they've been putting board games in. And
has anyone made a board game, like a drunk board game?
Oh, there's got to be. There's drinking games, isn't there?
But yeah. That's an idea then, Dragon's Den. So yeah, we'll pop you a link to this. It's interesting though. You know, board games are cool. I think it's cool to see them coming back again. It keeps it old school, isn't it? Back to roots.
Yeah, but I guess people aren't gathering around gaming next to each other, so they need some way to do it. So a board game, go back to that.
Social interaction.
Yeah, that's the way.
Now, someone who's making the transition away from games to another platform, good old Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, I couldn't believe this. I just looked up and they're making a Sonic movie.
Now, is this going to be new Sonic the Hedgehog with his hipster scarf and his...
Most likely.
Bandages around his legs.
Well, he's got a big beard.
Yeah, well, it's... Of course, there have been two, or maybe even more, actually, Sonic the Hedgehog cartoon series on TV, haven't there? By the look of this, it looks like it might be a spin-off of the animated series. It was about 2 years ago, I think.
Okay, I didn't catch that.
I've watched a few of them. I mean, this is where... You know the Wii U games that are coming out now?
Yeah.
So it's basically the same Sonic the Hedgehog that's on the animated TV series. So I think they've kind of reimagined the series to be like a kid's character again.
Yeah, they said it's going to be live action and animation hybrid.
Okay, that's interesting.
So maybe Sonic will have a human girlfriend again, which is always really creepy.
Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, that's it. So.
But yeah, I mean, I did watch a few of the recent animated series on Kodi, actually, one of the plugins on there. One of the dodgy ones.
Yep.
And there's some funny moments in it, but they've made like Knuckles is suddenly this massive, like, muscle-bound jock. And yeah, the characters are all, you can tell they're all aimed at like young kids and that, but there is actually some quite funny lines in it when you watch it.
Yeah.
And Eggman fails every week like he always does.
Oh, of course.
If this is going to be a spin-off of that, it's called Sonic the Hedgehog Lost World, which I think was actually the title of one of the recent Wii U games, so it probably is the same kind of... kind of characters in that.
I don't know if it'll be a big release, or we'll see.
Yeah, you might enjoy it if you've got, you know, the mind of an 8-year-old like me. Amiga Tennis Champs.
Yeah.
About this, Robbie.
So I saw this. I'd never seen the original game, which is basically came with Amiga Power, and it was just a little game called Tennis Champs, and then it got really popular, so they turned it into Super Tennis Champs.
Oh, I do remember this. Yeah, was it a cover disc, wasn't it?
Yeah, and now it's coming out for the iOS, but it looks really nice. Even the original game I was looking at the footage of, it looks amazingly good.
So the iOS release is called Tennis Champs Returns, and yes. There is a trailer they've got as well, so it's only going to be $1.99. So...
Yeah, because I used to play Pete Sampras tennis on the Mega Drive.
That was an awesome game.
Yeah, because remember, you could put the controllers into the top of the actual car.
Yeah, so you could have four players.
Yeah, yeah, and there was a treat, so you could get dizzy to walk across the,
the net.
Walk across the net and smash him. Yeah, this looks really, really like kind of Sampras or that era of tennis.
It's always cool when you get updates. I've got a few on my iPhone, actually, that I've actually just smashed today for the first time. I've had iPhones for nine years now.
Dropped it in the car park outside the
studio. As we're coming into the studio today, I've just broke the bloody thing. So when I get my screen replaced, I will download this game. But I've also got Pinball Fantasies on there as well.
Oh, nice, yeah.
So that's really cool when you're like on a train or something. And I've got, on my iPad, I've got Monkey Island 1 and 2, you know, the special editions with all the talking and everything. So it's cool that you can download these updated versions of classic games.
Well, I've got a little tiny fetish for tennis games, kind of, you know, these old classic ones, Sampras, you know, Virtue Tennis was always good, and then Rockstar did that amazing tennis game as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't watch tennis, but I love playing the games.
I'm the same, I quite enjoy them. Even there was one that came out, you know, the Sonic and Sega All-Stars Tennis, I think it was called, came out on the Xbox 360, that was awesome. But yes, I'm the same though, I find it very boring to watch on TV. I can't play it for love nor money in real life, but
actually, I did see a really good match the other day, but yeah, with Andy Murray. Anyway.
Was he smiling?
Not by the end.
And the final story this week, then, before we speak to Mr. Mike Montgomery, take video games seriously.
Yes, take video games seriously. So this is Naomi Alderman, who is a video games journalist, and she's writing for The Guardian, and she says, why don't we have award ceremonies like the Music Awards? Why don't we have, you know, these massive things of the game industry? It's one of the biggest industries, and it's portrayed as being spotty, nerdy, sexist teenagers who have a hobby of harassing people online. You know?
Do you think it's still got that image?
I think the mainstream media sees it that way. You know, there's these kind of cool older kids as well that use it, but it's still very... Yeah.
Well, I was reading the other day that apparently the average age for a gamer now is 36.
36?
36 is the average age of people that buy video games now. Because I think it's because, you know, people of that, you know, kind of our generation, isn't it? People who were born when games were just really affordable in the home. You know, we got computers when we were kids. But, like, our parents didn't.
That's it. I think...
We grew up with them, so...
I think what she says, her main point here is that... I want to suggest another reason that the games aren't treated as a cultural medium are that the games industry doesn't care enough to make it happen. If they wanted, they could do. And I think it's true as well. You know, they're more interested in making money, to be honest, than cementing their legacy. You know, the amount of games companies that have just disappeared and, you know, they only talk about themselves afterwards. They're never cementing their legacy, apart from Apple.
And, I think it's because the games market is so fragmented these days as well, though, isn't it? If you're looking at AAA games, but I mean, there are some very, you know, artistic and creative indie games, as we've mentioned before on this show, but then a lot of them are just small teams and they haven't really got the platform to get themselves in front of, like, mainstream media, have they? So
that's it. And I suppose you have to invest to, you know...
Or sell out.
Yeah.
Well, like, we spoke about Minecraft before. It's a perfect example, isn't it, of a game that started as an indie project. Is it Microsoft own it now?
Yeah, Microsoft, yeah.
So, yeah, it's an interesting point. And we mentioned even, you know, there isn't a mainstream gaming television programme on telly anymore. You used to get bad influence and Games Master, nothing like that, really.
Well, I guess it's just down to us guys, like retro podcasters and guys, to kind of take on the mainstream media and promote these things.
Well, you make a good point there, though. Do you need mainstream media when you've got the internet?
Yeah, no, we'll equalise it.
Yeah. Forget The Guardian, stick with us.
Yeah.
Right, thank you very much for listening to this week's episode, guys. Of course, you can get The Retro Hour every week from our website, theretrohour.com. We're on iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube, all the usual places. And we're going to leave you now with one of the legends of the gaming industry.
Yeah, Managing Director of Bitmap Brothers, Mike Montgomery.
And we'll catch you next week.
Catch you next week.
So first of all, we'll get a little bit of background on you, Mike. What first got you into video games?
Well, actually, I was a retail manager for Woolies, and it was really funny because when I was working in the store, computer printouts came out to show me how to lay the store out, and I went, what's a computer? Because when I was at school, you know, I mean, I'm an old boy, you know, and I didn't do computer studies because it meant going down to the local college, and they come back with these punch cards, and I thought, well, the punch cards were very useful for, you know, you used to get wool and, you know, put them through the holes and make patterns and pictures and stuff like that. That was really boring. Mm-hmm. So when this computer printouts came along, I thought, well, I need to know what a computer is. And so I started to do a bit of research, and the ZX81 was out. So I bought one of those and started, you know, playing with it. I didn't know anyone that was in the computer industry at all or anyone who actually had one. So I learned how to do machine code and stuff like that, and then I went on to the Spectrum and wrote a disassembler and an assembler, hacked a few things and fixed a few bugs in other things, and then thought, well, one day, how good am I? And I went for an interview. PCW, do you remember that weekly magazine?
Magazine, yes.
I went for an interview there at Leisure Genius, and they interviewed me, and it was really funny because I only went there to find out how good I was, and they said, well, can you start Monday? And I went, no. I got a good job. I just want to know, well, you're good, you know. Anyway, cut a long story short, after about, I think it was about a week, we negotiated and I started working for them, and that's where I started, really.
So it was kind of by accident then, you just fell into it?
Yeah, yeah, but I think I'm a natural. I'm not being funny, but it was problem solving, what I used to do, you know, as a manager and to solve problems, and I just enjoyed it. I'm still, I'm still programming now, I'm getting paid for my hobby.
So how did that lead to the Bitmap Brothers forming?
Well, I worked for Leisure Genius. They got bought out by Virgin. In between that time, I met Steve Kelly, one of my ex-partners. He was working on Scrabble on the Spectrum, and I was doing Scrabble on the 64, all sorts of machines. So we got talking, and we really got on well, went out for a few beers, and Eric came along. When we were doing Monopoly, and he did some graphics, so we sort of got friends, and then they said, oh, well, we've got this, we're doing this Xenon, it was, mm-hmm. called Kelly X, and we need somebody to sort of port it to the Amiga, and I went, oh, I'll do it. And then it just went from there, really.
What did you think of the Amiga when you first got your hands on one?
Interesting question. I really liked it. There was the copper chip, you know, the sound chip, everything. It's just, you know, the first thing you did was get rid of the operating system and just you could really get into the hardware.
Now, I will say, Mike, you guys always seemed like rock stars when you used to read about you in the magazines and stuff. Yours looked really cool, and there was obviously that infamous, you know, picture of you guys in front of the helicopter and that. Was your image a conscious thing then that you were thinking about?
Oh, it was very conscious, extremely, because I mean, sadly, we've gone back to those days for different reasons. But, you know, when a program came out, it was a game by Ocean. It was a game by Mirrorsoft. It was a game by whoever, you know. And we said, well, you don't go into a record shop and buy an Apple record. You buy Michael Jackson. So that's how we started. And we wanted to change the industry, and I think we did it to an extent where you weren't buying a game because it was by Ocean. You were buying a game because it was by the Bitmap Brothers. And we're the artists, we're not the publishers. And it's the artist that needs the recognition. Nowadays, you know, computer games has got such mass market and there's so many people working, it's really hard. But there's still lots of names out there, designers and stuff like that, that you know, will make a game famous. I mean, what was it the other week? Someone's got recognition for as a designer. It's him, not the game, you know? And that's what it should be all about.
And you kind of had Sensible that were trying to look cool, you know, Psygnosis were trying to look cool, but you seemed to top them all by getting a helicopter. Where did you get the helicopter from?
Well, one of the things we did with Mirrorsoft is that it was written into the contract that we would do a lot of the PR, and they had to give us a PR people to help us promote ourselves, which they were, you know, Mirrorsoft really up for it. And we had our own photographer, and we said, why don't we do it by a helicopter? Maxwell's got a helicopter. So we went to the mirror building it wasn't in Fleet Street, but very close.
This is Robert Maxwell we're talking about here.
Yes, that's right. We went there, and we got permission to take pictures of the helicopter just before they put it away. The biggest problem is that we went there at, I think it must have been 10 o'clock in the morning, and he was at Epsom horse racing, and he was supposed to come back. He didn't come back. And we just sat there all day on top of the Mirrorsoft building waiting, because we knew we only had like 10, 15 minutes. And then all of a sudden the helicopter comes in, Maxwell gets out, moves on, and we've got permission to take the pictures just at sunset. It was just a miracle, almost, you know, and a good photographer. And then we just clicked the photographs, and that was it. And they were so good, everyone published them.
They were everywhere, weren't they?
But that was our attitude, that it, to an extent, going back to the pop world, if you do something that's really good and looks good, everyone will put it in their magazine, because I'm not putting magazines down, but it's easy editorial, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And people want to look at it and stuff like that. So we always made sure that our pictures were really, really good.
Well, Ravi did kind of mention the narrative behind the games there. Was it like a friendly rivalry that you guys had with Sensible then, would you say?
You've been talking to Jobs, haven't you?
We did have him on the other week, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let him answer that question. I thought it was friendly, but at the time, I'm not sure it was.
Now, many of your games, you could say, you know, even at the time, they were considered now especially cult classics. You know, we're talking titles like Chaos Engine, Speedball Gods. Is there one that you're, like, most proud of or most fond of?
Cadaver. I enjoyed working on Cadaver. Steve Kelly did most of it, but I did some really good programming on it. I mean, I did a bit of programming probably in everything that we've actually done.
Mm-hmm.
I think my most proud actually was Steel Soldiers, because I did a lot of the design as well. Magic Pockets, actually. You know what, with Magic Pockets, it's really weird because people either, it's like Marmite, hate it or love it.
It wasn't as successful as the other titles, was it?
It made a profit. Some of the others didn't.
So you mentioned Zed there, as Steel Soldiers. I knew that the game Zed was intended for release with the Amiga, and then Click Boom got involved later, and there was.
As I say, Click Boom does ring a bell, but I not for those reasons, I don't think. I mean, we had obviously, you know, Zed was actually started off on the Amiga. I mean, Zed took nearly 7 years from start to finish, and went through many variations before it actually came out on the PC. And we actually did have, just before the release, we did have almost a working version on the Amiga, but there was no Amiga market there then. Click Boom, it rings a bell, but not for the reasons.
Yes, because I guess that was after Chaos Engine 2, and you kind of revealed to me that, you know, there was a very small amount of copies that were sold for the Amiga.
Oh, I mean, Chaos Engine 2, I mean, I wish I'd, you know, I threw hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of boxes away. I wish I'd kept them, because on eBay, they're going for about 40 or 50 quid.
Oh.
Would have made a fortune, you know, 20 years or 10 years, like 15 years later, whatever it was. You know, Chaos Engine 2 was just, we should have canned it. There was no market when it came out.
Was that game well received at the time, did you think, Corks? And it was very different to the first one, wasn't it?
Was it well received? Well, there was only 4,000 people bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably, the market then was probably 4,001. So I think, yes, it did really well.
How did the demise of Commodore and the Amiga affect you guys?
In some respects, really badly. I think more to the point is that, I mean, the Amiga, you know, it just suddenly died after Amiga went broke, but so did the ST, and they didn't go broke with that. It was a case of moving on. It was when the consoles started to come out, wasn't it? Probably PlayStation 1 was around about that time. And then it started opening up to a different mass market, if you like, or massive market to what it was. And the biggest problem, I think, with the bitmaps is that we went off of the PC. We should have gone off from consoles. But console development was extremely expensive. In the early days, there wasn't many independent developers that were doing anything on the consoles because they couldn't afford it. This is when all the bigger companies like EA started to come in. You know, the dev kits were like tens, if not more than tens of thousands of pounds. We didn't have that money.
I can remember on the SNES, Chaos Engine was released under the name Soldiers of Fortune. Why was that?
It was actually released on other formats as called Soldiers of Fortunes as well, because that was in America. They didn't. The Americans, I'm going to get into a lot of trouble here. The Americans probably still don't understand English. They didn't understand Chaos Engine, apart from it was renamed to Soldiers of Fortune, and we were told if it wasn't renamed, we wouldn't sell any units, which is probably true in America. Also, the preacher, they couldn't allow one of the characters, preacher, yet to become the scientist. They're not politically correct. I think, I'm going to get into trouble with Americans. I think I'll shut up now.
Were there any many unreleased Amiga projects that you guys didn't get out then in the end?
Well, there was one project, yes. It was a project called Bike. We're doing a book on the Bitmap Brothers. You'll read that. It's one of the chapters. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
What made you want to write a book then about it?
My mate Jobs. There was a book came out about Sensible Soccer. People have been asking about it for years. You know, you should do it. And I went, no. And then I went to the launch of Sensible Soccer book. And when John says he did his speech, which is extremely good, it persuaded me because he said it's history.
Mm-hmm.
We need this to be history. We need people to understand, you know, how the Bitmap Brothers were formed, how much they did for the industry, and how the industry was, and how and how not only me but all the others have made it into the biggest industry in the entertainment industry in the world. You know, and we're British, so therefore, let's make a history book.
I think there is a lot of that, though, at the time when it was happening. Maybe a lot of us didn't realise the importance of what you guys were doing back then. Do you think there's something in that in hindsight you realise it more than you did at the time?
Well, I think we realised it because, I mean, you know, that's why we promoted ourselves as pop stars, you know, to change that attitude. But I don't think even then that we realised how big games were going to be. And I don't think anyone else could do, otherwise there'd be an awful lot of rich people out there.
And when you mentioned, obviously, in the mid-90s, when it was that change from, because the Amiga and the ST, even though they were computers that were designed in America, they really were bigger this side of the pond, weren't they? But then when, like, the PlayStation came along and stuff like that, did you find it became a more of a global thing?
You're going to get me into trouble with Americans again. You know what? It wasn't many years ago when this world was run by American publishers, probably still is, but probably going back about 10, 12 years, when they said that a game had to be a prop between 12 and 20 hours of gameplay, because the audience have an attention span of about that. I'm talking about nowadays where, you know, games should, you know, when you're paying 50, 60 quid, you know, they should have at least a lot more game hours than 12.
Yeah.
In fact, actually, I think it was actually 4 hours. The attention span of a person is about 4 hours. But that comes out of America.
But I think what's also different now is games hold your hand a lot more. So, you know, it's kind of impossible that you're not going to make it through those 4 hours, because the game will help you if you need to.
I think I'll rest my case.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? You know, but back in the old days, I mean, I must have played the first level of Chaos Engine like 10,000 times over the years. But you play it again and again and again. It's, I think you spend a lot more time on it back then.
And I guess they do single-player games and then go, oh, we'll extend the game life by adding a multiplayer function, you know.
How many modern games do you play over and over and over again?
Not many. Only multiplayer ones, really, online.
Yeah.
Well, some of your old games, like, you know, Speedball 2 and Chaos Engine, they both had re-releases and updates on PC in recent years. Why did you decide to do that then?
Well, to keep the names going, actually, in some respects. Most of the releases we've actually had are very similar to what the original was. And really, because, you know, in those days when we did like Speedball and stuff like that, and Xenon and stuff like that, it was all about game planning, enjoying fun, you know. And there's a whole market out there, you know, of young people that haven't had that experience.
Have you got any plans to update anymore?
What's this space?
When can we expect the Bitmap Brothers book then, if we want to find out more about the story? It sounds interesting.
I hope within the next couple of months. It's turned out to be a bigger project than we thought. We tried our hardest, and we still are, to interview most of the people that either work for the Bitmaps or are involved. And I think it'd be really interesting, because it's not about the politics of the bitmaps, it's not about the business, it's about games and the people that worked on them.
Well, I always found it interesting that the Bitmap Brothers kind of had all different musical influences and different musical artists working on there, like John Fox working for Speedball 2.
Yeah.
And, you know, Betty Boo for the other one, the copy of that. Would that be included in the book?
Some of the artists that have written the music are interviewed, and why they did it. It would be interesting.
Betty
I don't
Boo.
Want to spoil it.
Well, Betty Boo is an interesting inclusion, though. It's just, you know, I remember the song reading the charts and in the game as well, and it was like, it's the first time I'd ever heard, like, you know, a real song in a video game, I think.
I think, yeah, we chose it because it really fitted the product.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually quite hard to get. It was quite hard to record at the time, but it was a real buzz, you know. It was very different, because it was pop music rather than music that we'd gone to an artist and got written specially, because it fitted. And it's quite amazing, because that track was good at the time, you know. It was pop music, but you don't hear it in the top 100, do you? And yet, I think I was doing something on my car about 3 or 4 months ago, and I had the radio on, and it came on, and it just gave me that nice, warming feeling that something with that.
You'll have to wait for Mega Blast to come on the radio as well.
I do hear Magic Pockets more than Betty Boo these days, though, to be fair.
Really? Yeah. Well, the thing is, of course, the other thing we met with the Mega Blast from Xenon is that it was the first... It was the first commercial piece of music to be done in pseudo 3D, surround sound, yeah? And it was actually featured on Tomorrow's World, and it's on a BBC record somewhere.
Yeah, because they released it on vinyl, I remember, and there was...
Yeah.
I think that clip's on YouTube, actually. I think I've seen it.
But as I say, it was on Tomorrow's World, which was... Well, I don't know if you remember Tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a scientific thing, because it was the first 3D soundtrack, pseudo soundtrack.
There was also Electrophere, which was the album with Into the Wonderful, with John Fox on as well, which was Gods.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. He released the album Electrophere, which was part of Nation 12.
Yeah.
His kind of collective. Yeah, so you've got quite a few tunes on vinyl.
There's also like, what was it? I can't remember the brothers that did the soundtrack for Chaos Engine. I've got 12 inches in the loft.
Ah, of the Chaos Engine theme. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I've got a few of those.
Was music a very important part of your the game design process for the Bitmap Brothers? Because it was always something that you always remember a Bitmap Brothers tune on the games.
If you're into music, you would do. Mm-hmm. yes and no. What makes a good computer game? The music? Yes. The graphics? Yes. The programming? Yes. Sound effects? Yes. It's the whole lot. If you put the whole lot that's actually brilliant, then you have a brilliant project. You can release a game with just a really good soundtrack, but if it's not a good game, it won't sell. Well, actually, it's quite interesting. If you look at the 007 films, straight up, this is slightly different to what I said, but strangely enough, the 007s that didn't actually do the figures, the soundtracks never did figures either.
Yeah, interesting correlation.
Wow.
Now, Michael will say one thing. Obviously, you were at the Amiga 30 event last year. What's it kind of like meeting fans who grew up with your games and find your games so important?
Actually, the Amiga 30, this was the one that was in England. The most fascinating thing was actually the speeches that were about the Amiga and how it started and the business side of it were actually a lot more interesting because I knew nothing about that at all. Meeting all the, because actually the one in England, actually it was more about actually meeting people that worked on the Amiga. There wasn't that many fans there. There was a few, but it's great. But I went to the one in Poland, which was all about fans and not about, well, apart from me and Jobs and a few others, quite a few others, but it was more fan based.
That was a Pixeland, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, great show.
I've heard it's really big, just thousands of people.
I went there the year before. It was amazing, and actually they didn't invite me last year, so I was a bit upset. So I went on my own anyway. And next year they're inviting me because they've got no choice.
But I know, even talks like David Pleasance from Commodore, he was overwhelmed by how many people still turn up to these shows and still hold the Amiga in that era in such high regard.
Absolutely, totally. If you go to some of the retro shows around the country, not only Amiga, but the Amiga is the big one, but also for the ST and some of the other machines, it's massive. And you know what? You would think that they're all old gits like me, but they're not. Mm. You even get sort of like 14-year-olds coming because it's been passed down the generations, and they understand that a great game's great because of the gameplay, not about all the graphics. The graphics were great at the time, but not in today's standards. But the gameplay was brilliant, you know, and you got lots of fun out of it.
And I guess their dads, like, shoved them in front of an old machine and said, play this.
I mean, it was quite interesting. A few years ago, not that many years ago, I was in London on a tube, and you know, this is what gives me a buzz. There was two young guys. Well, they weren't young. They were about 25 to 30, and they were sitting on the seat next to me, and they were talking about Speedball 2 and what a great game it was, and how they used to, and I'm thinking, oh, that made me really proud. I didn't say a word. I couldn't. I was absolutely, I was speechless, actually. That was probably the most amazing moment I've ever had, apart from winning awards, probably.
Well, that's the legacy of the Bitmap Brothers, though, Michael. It's been amazing having you on and reminiscing about the old days. And we look forward to the book as well, which, as you said, should be out in the next couple of months.
Cool, yeah, cool. No. It'll be really good. I'm really, considering I didn't want to do it in the first place, I'm really happy and proud about it now.
If Jobs did it, you had to there, didn't you, really?
I've got to beat him at everything. He always loses against me, but he tries very hard.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Mike.
No problem at all.